This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to The People Speak, here where we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. We are honored to have with us this evening an icon of peace and spirituality, Dr. and the Most Reverend Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Nobel Peace Prize winner of 1984. Sir, it is a pleasure and a privilege having you on our show. Welcome to The People Speak Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here.
Archbishop Tutu, in the presentation of your Nobel Peace Prize award, the first paragraph read, "You are a unifying figure in the campaign to solve South Africa's apartheid problem by peaceful means." And it went on to say, "The situation as it is today is such that a peaceful solution is by no means inevitable. The repression was so brutal that a violent rebellion would have been an understandable reaction. Yet you chose peaceful resolution to the conflict, sir. In a planet that is facing a potential world war, Archbishop Tutu, started by America's illegal invasion of Iraq, how does one become a beacon of peace in the midst of something as horrifying as shock and awe?"
Well, thank you very much. It's quite important to stress that I just happen to be one of many. I happened to have been there where people accepted me as a leader. But the real heroes, the real heroines, were all those many people who were prepared to put their lives on the line, standing up for what they believed to be the truth, standing up for justice, standing up for peace. But it was not only the people in South Africa. In fact, we are quite certain that we would not have made it at all without the incredible support that we received from the international community, not least from the many people, and particularly young people, college students in the United States. And so one has to remember that I think most people in the world, most normal people, want peace. It's always an aberration. They're going against what most of the people desire. If you had a poll and you went around the streets and you asked people, would you rather there was conflict and violence? I think that you'd almost get a 99.9% response saying we want peace.
And how does one defend oneself peacefully in the midst of invasion, in the midst of bombings, in the midst of it's an interesting perspective on how the world is seeing this. How do you do that? How do you suggest?
Well, I think, that obviously you want to galvanize as much public support for your position so that those who go against the desire of the majority can stand out like a sore thumb. It's extraordinary. How, for instance, in war situations, it has been the people who were vulnerable who were unarmed, who stood up in Germany. You had people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer who stood up against the might of the Nazis, who had nothing in a sense except their integrity, their belief. It was the same in India. I mean, when Mahatma Gandhi was leading that campaign against British occupation of India, he he had nothing. You know, he had just a stick in his hand. Of course, it's not true to say he had nothing. He had his incredible the strength of his integrity, of his character, and how he galvanized the so-called ordinary people. There are no ordinary people. Everybody is outstanding and extraordinary. But those whom we wrongly call the ordinary people, the ordinary people supported him. You've had it here. When you had your civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. and all of those who were involved in that said, we are not going to respond to the provocation of violence and oppression, the dogs, the batons, the nightsticks, and all of that. We're not going to respond in kind. We are going to say we care so much about what we believe in that we will not degrade it by using methods of which we will ultimately be ashamed.
What do you say to those in the world that say that violent rebellion actually makes more sense? And there is a large majority of people that believe that might is right and might makes
yeah.
a powerful and formidable force. What do you say to those people,
well,
Your Eminence?
My own reading, which would ultimately be the one that is supported by the evidence of history. My reading is that in the end, because we inhabit a moral universe, it is right that prevails. Let's look at the historical evidence. You look, even the most modern, most recent history, there was a time when Hitler, Mussolini, Franco were strutting around as if they were totally invincible. And they seemed to be carrying things, you know. I mean, they seemed to have been going to prevail. Hitler nearly conquered Europe, nearly. He didn't. In the end, he and his supporters ended up biting the dust. They were beaten. They were defeated. You look at people like Amin in Uganda. A horrendous dictator. You look at the people who were the perpetrators, supporters of apartheid in South Africa. There was a time when they were arrogant and believed that they would sweep everything in front of them. Their word was law, and it was law for a very, very, very long time. But in the end, you see, where are they today? Who are the ones who have prevailed? The people who get to prevail are ultimately those who stand up for truth, who stand up for justice, who stand up for goodness. Yeah, it frequently does take a very...
Your Eminence, that brings me to one of our a question that really has been pressing on my mind. One of our most respected guests in the past on the People Speak was a young man by the name of First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. Aaron and his family, first of all, are greatly honored and grateful for your support, Archbishop.
Yeah.
And herein lies a perfect example that I'm sure people around the world wonder about. Lieutenant Watada spoke out and chose the path of nonviolence after he discovered the war in Iraq was illegal. And according to the law of command responsibility, he would have been party to war crimes had he deployed to Iraq. He chose this path of nonviolence, and now he's being court-martialed.
Yeah.
Bishop Tutu, you chose nonviolence, and you won a Nobel Peace Prize. What do you tell people about such a dichotomy of injustice?
Well, as you know, I saluted this young man and said it was an extraordinary step that he took. We have obviously got to agree that in most normal circumstances, a soldier has got to carry out the orders of his superior officer. But this is not something that says it's universally so. You remember what happened at the end of World War II? The Nazis were brought to trial in Nuremberg, and many of them tried to use the excuse that we were carrying out orders. And the Nuremberg trial found that was not an acceptable excuse. You can't violate your own conscience. You can't violate normal laws of good, of right, and think that you can get away with the excuse that I was carrying out, I was merely obeying orders. I mean, in South Africa, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and we used to have many of those who had been employed by the government, the apartheid government, as police, as soldiers, and they came along saying, well, to justify what we did, we were carrying out orders. We said, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission said, that can never be an excuse. And you know, all of us know that, supposing, let's just take a very extreme example. Supposing your superior officer were to say to you, you must rape that woman. It is an order that I give you. This woman is part of the enemy, and the way we are going to fight against them is we use rape, as it is being used. In fact, it is being used in places like Burma. The military dictatorship there puts out its soldiers, many of whom are HIV positive, and give them orders to rape the women of the communities that they are trying to intimidate. Now, would you say yes? No, I am going to do carry out what is so blatantly and evil and unacceptable order, and you say, No, you can't.
Well, let me. The world would see it that way, sir, Your Eminence. They don't see it that way, I'm afraid. It is a beautiful and lovely sentiment, but we still have a young man that is facing years of hard time in prison.
Yes.
And will be discharged dishonorably from a military that he served honorably and loved. But by doing his duty, this is what, you know, let me ask, are you disappointed in the image of America created under the current Bush and Cheney administration? Guantanamo Bay, Aaron Watada, Abu Ghraib, the Patriot Act. What are you seeing from this?
I've always been able to make a distinction between the American people and their various administrations. When we were suffering under apartheid, the Reagan administration refused to impose sanctions on the apartheid government. They instead had a policy of so-called constructive engagement, and it was an abominable policy, and we condemned it as such, but we appealed over the heads of the administration to the people. And I spoke to you earlier about the role of young people. It wasn't just the young people, but it was particularly the students who were part of the anti-apartheid movement, who helped to change the moral climate in your country. And so what I am saying is that we've always got to make the distinction between what is your administration and one hopes that they are maybe a temporary feature, which they tend to be. And as you can see, I mean, there was a time in 2003 when the ratings of your president were going through the roof, more or less. I mean, he was untouchable.
That we returned him for a second term in office.
Well, yes. I mean, I still sometimes do not understand you.
I do not understand that myself, Your Eminence.
But you still have to say that what is now happening is that people are saying it is unacceptable for whatever reasons. And so I want to underscore what I have said, that we've got to make the distinction between the American people and the particular administration that is in power at a particular time. And I have to say, I have found, I mean, and I've said so many times, I found the policy regarding Iraq, the reason for going to war, even the decision to go to war, I said so then that it was an immoral war because it was being a war declared by an illegal, an illegitimate authority in terms of what the church calls the just war theory. And one is deeply, deeply distressed. I mean, Guantanamo Bay, what I find so sad as someone who was involved in apartheid, what I find so sad is to hear America, the country which inspired so many of us in our own struggles for peace, using the same justification for the monstrosity of Guantanamo Bay, using the same arguments to justify it that were used by the apartheid government in South Africa for justifying detention without trial. And I say, I didn't believe I would live to see the day when the United States, and Britain as well. I mean, Britain under Prime Minister Blair has its own detention without trial situation. And they, too.
Yes, they do. Yes, they are equally as guilty.
Yeah, they were using the same arguments. And I say, I mean, I'm appalled. And then the second thing is the fact that actually that there has been, so far as I can make out, very little real outrage in your community. That has surprised me and shocked me that Americans have not, by and large, I mean, I know that there are very many who have expressed their disgust, but by and large, there has been an acquiescence in the in the monstrosity of Guantanamo Bay.
You know, in an interview, when you talk about the support that America has suddenly been perceived as giving, using, like you said, the same excuses that were used in apartheid South Africa, in an interview, Your Eminence, you said, if apartheid ended, so can the occupation, but the moral force and international pressure will have to be just as determined. Apartheid is a powerful word and holds a deep meaning for the world as we witness the images of brutality during the struggle against apartheid South Africa. Mm-hmm. Palestine has been called an apartheid state by President Jimmy Carter, by Nelson Mandela, and many other world leaders. What are your thoughts on the comparisons between apartheid South Africa and apartheid Palestine? And how do you feel about the role that Israel plays in the brutal occupation of the indigenous Palestinians?
Yes. I think it is important to say that Israel in itself, I mean, it is a democracy. And I mean, one particular example is that very recently a retired judge put out a scathing report on the conduct of the Prime Minister with regard to the invasion of Lebanon. Of course, he didn't condemn him for attacking Lebanon, but for how they carried out. And I think it is important to recognize that there is that level of freedom. It is a democracy, yes, but in its policies towards the Palestinians, I speaking as a victim of the apartheid brutalities, would say the things that I saw with my own eyes, the checkpoint and the conduct of those young Israeli soldiers, reminded me very, very poignantly of the same kind of conduct and the same kind of arrogance, the same kind behaving as if the occupied people were just nothing. I saw that, but it was also listening to Palestinians. I mean, they would say, you know, that house over there, that used to be my home. Now, I, coming from South Africa, had heard quite a number of the so-called colored people in South Africa saying of homes in Cape Town, that used to be my home. We were turfed out. And of course, now it is symbolized more horrendously by the wall, a wall that has grabbed so much of Palestinian land, a wall that has separated families, and a wall that has been declared illegal by the International Court of
Community,
Justice.
Yes.
I still would want to say, we want to appeal to the very many decent people in Israel, and there are very, very many who stand up against the kinds of things that we have been speaking about. And remember, I mean, that there are very, very many Israelis who are appalled at the conduct with regard to the Palestinians. But we've also got to say that the behavior of those who are then attack as suicide bombers. If we are going to be consistent and have a credibility, we have to say we are opposed to all forms of violence, whoever the perpetrator may be.
And to say,
I mean, that the way forward is not the current policies, because the current policies do not in any way guarantee that there will be security. We learned that in South Africa, that security will never come from the barrel of a gun. Security comes when all people begin to feel that their fundamental rights are recognized and are respected. And one has to say that the way forward in the Middle East is to have a genuine two-state solution where you have a sovereign, independent Israel with its borders guaranteed, and an Israel that is accepted by the Arab community, and the Arab League have said so, that they are very willing to accept Israel.
Yes, they have, and as a matter of fact, they have accepted Israel as a
now and also to have a viable Palestinian state, not something that has been truncated, as is likely to be happening with the increasing Jewish settlements that keep being allowed, that you've got to have a viable state with contiguous boundaries, and maybe...
Reverend, may I ask you something?
Yeah.
You wrote a book, I believe in the 90s, that was called No Future Without Forgiveness. Presuming that we must, that as we must presume, because I can't imagine a world of continued strife in the region, that the occupation of Palestine and the apartheid policies of Israel against the Palestinians will cease. How do people start the process of forgiving and healing? You wrote a book about this. Obviously, you had to deal with issues in South Africa in light of the events that transpired.
You know, I mean, I need to point out that actually we are not peculiar in South Africa. I've just come from Taiwan, and we've been amazed at the things that we've seen there of the desire of so many Taiwanese to forgive some of the horrible, horrible things that were done to them by the Chinese under Chiang Kai-shek. I mean, we were told about someone who had been a lawyer who opposed Chiang Kai-shek, and his mother was one day killed, as well as his twin daughters. Do you know, we had a church service, and the church service was in the house of this man. It has been the house in which the murders occurred has been turned into a church. Now, it's not peculiarly South African to have people being willing to be magnanimous and forgiving. In South Africa itself, a young American girl called Amy Beale was killed brutally in one of the townships, and her parents went from here in California to support the granting of amnesty to the people who had murdered their daughter. They were willing to be forgiving. And they have set up a foundation, the Amy Beale Foundation, in the very township in which their daughter was killed, to help salvage young blacks from the violence of their community. So it isn't just that we are wonderful people. It is a universal attribute, the desire of people not to revenge, not to seek retribution. It's something that is found all over the world. It is just that you frequently need courageous leaders to to give momentum.
And you are that. And while
no.
We were lucky, Your Eminence.
We were lucky because we had people like Nelson Mandela. Now we've got to finish. can we finish?
With one more question, I beg of you. And then I promise that's it. I have promised His Eminence that we would not overtax him this evening. But this is an important question, sir. While the chairman of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you said that the path of restorative justice was not necessarily the best path, that we needed to transform offenders into responsible citizens. Africa's exploding with violence, Your Eminence.
Yeah.
What is being done currently to help ease the crime that's rampant there? And how does a nation transform from such a monumental situation?
Yes. Well, we're talking about not retributive justice, restorative justice where we're saying we're seeking to heal. We are saying that one of the wonderful things is that despite all of those problems that we have, it is amazing, given where we come from, that we could still have the kind of stability where you don't have an uprising of blacks who are still largely poor in South Africa, an uprising of blacks angry that they still live in shacks, that they still are unemployed, whereas most of the white people are the ones who are the affluent ones, that we haven't had people going on the rampage. And that, I think, is a testimony to the ultimate strength of the path of restorative justice, of forgiveness, of looking for reconciliation. Okay?
Thank you, Your Eminence. It has been an unbelievable honor. You have
God
been
bless
wonderful.
You.
I appreciate your questions and answers, and this has just been wonderful. Thank you, sir, very much. You
God
have
bless
a
you.
Great
Bye-bye.
Evening.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that's it, folks. I'm afraid Reverend the Archbishop was extremely tired from a trip, and we did promise him only half an hour. Thank you all for being here. This has just been wonderful. I want to thank everybody that helped with the show. Again, our producer was just amazing that we were able to solidify and have the eminent Archbishop Desmond Tutu on our show. Next week, I'm thinking tonight's Tuesday. Tuesday night, tomorrow night, David Swanson, activist and congressman, will be an activist, and he will be here with Malik Johnson, who is my co-host. And Wednesday evening, we will have Dennis Kucinich. I will be interviewing the congressman on Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock. Both of these are airing at 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And, of course, we will have a lot more time for interaction with our audience. I appreciate all of you. And thank you very much. We're going to call it a show. Great, great, great audience. Thank you. And thank you so much to our listeners. Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night. Bye-bye, everyone.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the distant wall, by the relief of the past, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you. And